This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. I want you to come along with me and meet the residents at Pine Haven Estates. One of them, for instance, moved to an area to be close to the grave of her former lover. Another one's faking dementia to avoid having to deal with his adult son. Oh, and then there's the cat who wanders around the facility, and he may be able to predict who will die next. Jill McCorkle's first novel in 17 years is called Life After Life, and those are some of the characters who populate her book. She'll be reading tonight at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill at 7, and she is on the program now. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Now, you're, you know, an author in your, what, late 20s, and you've set this thing in a retirement home. How's it coming?
That's very kind.
A retirement home setting? Is this something you're thinking about lots? That's the setting for this book, and I wonder why.
Yeah, well, it focuses on the assisted living nursing dwelling, with the idea that too is a microcosm for all of society. I mean, I think nothing changes. You know, the personalities, you could just as easily maybe be in a dormitory, right, with some of these characters.
Of course, what does change is memories over time, and particularly the way we see those memories, that in any present moment, the way we look back at a particular event in our lives can also change from minute to minute. It's a kind of a great meditation on how that works in us, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I really wanted to give the sense of whole lives, people, you know, there at the end with time to reflect on the highs and the lows, and to just figure out and understand a lot of things, and also, you know, just because you see the finish line doesn't mean you need to stop running.
Well, not only do we see it from their point of view, but you've given us really two perspectives, more than that, but each of their own perspective. But we have a kind of an objective observer as well, the point of view of Joanna, who not only narrates but also keeps a diary, which is a much more detailed look at,
right,
at these. Why did you come up with that as a way, as a kind of frame for this?
The beginning notions of Joanna's character probably started 20 years ago when I was with my dad as he was dying. And it was my first real experience with hospice workers, and they were just absolute angels, these selfless people coming and going. And it was just such a moving time in life because I was first of all shocked at how my own life continued so easily in the midst of this very sad situation. And I think we often think that in such a case, everything else would pause for us to absorb and deal with it. But instead, I was grading papers to fly back and teach my class the next week. I was fixing lunch for the kids, paying bills. And so I felt so fragmented as I was watching. I was kind of in awe of what is the natural process of death and the way the body is conserving as much energy as possible for the heart. And I also, you know, could not help but wonder what my own dad was thinking, feeling, actually hearing through it all. And so I was taking notes the whole time, just as a way to sort of keep myself afloat, and really found that I had these three different parts of myself present. And I think a lot of the characters at this final stage in life are juggling all of these, right, fragments of their lives as they're pulling together, you know, what is the meaning and real focus at the end.
And it's interesting. I think one of the wonderful things that happens in this book for a reader like me anyway is to be able to see what happens when you have your own kind of subjectivity, what you're feeling either as an observer or as the one who's near the end. But you're always pulled out of that by these other objective observers, these medical caregivers, these loving caregivers who do have to take notes on your vital signs. And it just forces you to see yourself and your condition in a new way. So you see your, you know, you get to see your parts, you know, you get to see your printout.
Exactly.
As well as sort of meditate on these other deeper questions that are very personal.
Well, I think throughout the novel, there's a lot of discussion about the inner life and the outer life. And I wanted the reader to experience that, to sort of swing between the activity of what the characters are actually doing on the surface, all of the conversation and the comings and the goings, and then also to show what is that most introspective part. I mean, I think for me, the real challenge as a writer in getting to know my characters is to, I want to be fully aware of what this person loves more than anything else on earth, and what is most likely to cause pain and sorrow. And once I know those two things, everything else falls into place. And of course, great suspense is drawn out of me knowing those things and the other characters not. And so that was a lot of what was going on as I was putting it together.
And the characters are vivid. They are full-blown, whole characters who you just love and occasionally become annoyed with. and they're delightful. And I would have to tell me about Sadie, because if I had to guess, I would say Sadie was your favorite character, if you want to pick a favorite child.
Certainly Sadie is one of my favorite. I mean, I've really had fun with all of them, but for me, I guess I lean towards Sadie because I really see her as the ideal. I mean, she would be the ideal I think we'd all like to aspire to. She has had loss and sadness in her life, but there's not a trace of bitterness. She's come to the end. She's proud of who she is. She's proud of how she's lived. She's comfortable in her skin. She has remained compassionate, generous, very aware of what other people are in need of. So for me, you know, she's just shy of walking on water. And I was aware that I was taking her dangerously close to sainthood, but she does for me represent someone who has just come out the end of life in the best possible way.
Maybe close to sainthood, but absolutely plausible. I know Sadie, and I know others who know Sadie. And then there's Stanley, who's far less saintly, I would say, in some ways, although delightful guy from time to time.
Oh yeah, I had a lot of fun with Stanley. His faking dementia, you know, backfires on him pretty quickly. He has put himself in a box that he doesn't want to stay in. But I think many of the characters have done that, and the novel in many ways is about people finding their ways out of what are their own traps.
Would you read for us?
Sure. This is a little bit of Sadie. As she takes one of her interior journeys. "I miss my other life," Sadie said to Stanley Stone. "I move room to room through my old house. I see the brightness of a late afternoon. I hear the rumble of the air conditioning there in the window in the den, what these days they call a family room, which sounds nice too. I see the hollyhocks at my window, tall and staked upright with their big powder puff blooms, and then just as suddenly I might smell the fire in the fireplace and hear Horace chopping wood. You'll be amazed at what all you can see, how the seasons change, the light and temperature, and then people come into the room and you hear the sweet voices of your young children, or I smell the cologne I wore for almost 20 years, a gift from Horace every Christmas, Shalimar. Just the word made me feel important. One day when a little girl, Susie Otis, there in bright-colored dungarees, told me I smelled so good, I had the whole room say, Shalimar, Shalimar, and they waved their hands like they held magic wands."
Life After Life is the name of the novel, and my guest is Jill McCorkle. She's going to be at Flyleaf Books tonight in Chapel Hill, and I guess all over the Triangle over the next few weeks, and you can find out more about that. But on our program today, she's talking to Stanley about the glory of her memories, her being able to revel in these things. And, of course, Stanley has used the absence of memory as a kind of a shield against his son, who he has a fraught relationship with.
Right. No, it's... You're exactly right. Sadie's memories are all comfort, except for, you know, the death of her husband, which she, but she keeps dealing with it.
Right.
And Stanley is having to revisit all the things he wishes he had done differently.
And so for him, the cheap way out is just to pretend to forget and hope that it takes. So, you know, so I'm a little annoyed with Stanley until I find out that he loves NPR. Listens to the news, and of course Garrison Keillor, because, well, he's in a rest home. But so
right.
There you go.
But
so that redeems him for me.
Yeah.
Did these characters come to you? I mean, had you met them? You talked about going through this with your father. Were these characters you met and were taking note of in that process, or did they come to you later as you're putting the book together? Where did you meet these characters?
Oh, I just take lots of notes. These characters came from different places at different times. The character Stanley actually grew out of my son in early adolescence. Was quite interested in professional wrestling entertainment, and so a couple of times, you know, I went with a bunch of boys to, you know, one of these big arenas for the show, and It's quite a show, worth seeing. I mean, and I took a whole lot of notes at those events. And of course, my son and I laughed about how it would be a great way to sort of repel people if you didn't want anyone to get near you, if you, you know, acted like you too were one of these guys about to take somebody out. And Stanley grew out of that very funny conversation. Oftentimes, I think for me, the idea of a character might begin with something comical or just larger than life, and then the challenge as a writer is to find the real heart beating inside that person.
But you do something I think that's even more challenging and quite successfully in this book, in that we've got all these narratives going, and they're subjective and objective, and it all holds together. I mean, clearly we're in one place, that's helpful, but there are sort of arch narratives that go through here about how we hold our memories together and who they are. Several times in the book, some version of "What was I thinking?" or mm-hmm. "God only knows what they were thinking." At a certain point, that repetition brings me to understand how fragile my own self is, you know, and how it's all dependent on how I see my own memories. But the book isn't that abstract. These are real characters. They're funny. They're alive. They're sad. I think that's the challenge that you met quite brilliantly.
Well, I think it was a challenge putting it together. I wanted the reader to go to a place that would not tie all the ends up neatly, you know, my version of what they should see, but to take them to a threshold that might invite the people they know, the situations they know, that might fill in the rest, or to bring these characters to a place where there are a lot of different possibilities.
Right.
I didn't want to slam and lock all the doors. In fact, I really wanted things left wide open.
Yeah, but the danger in doing that sometimes in a hand less deft than yours is that it is so wide open that it goes nowhere. But this brings me to I understand these characters. I like them. That's a whole story. And I'm brought to these abstract thoughts. And even magic. I mean, it's so well anchored that you can even toy with the idea of magic and things beyond the physical.
Yeah.
Is that something that's important to you, this kind of the realm of magic that's beyond a sort of physical description?
Well, I think what I was mostly interested in is magic, good sleight of hand as the art of distraction. And I think we live in a world that's just filled with the art of distraction. As a high school student, found our town very moving, just because of that emphasis on day-to-day living and how the dead then look back and wish for the simplest bits of a day. And I did experience that with my dad as he was dying, you know, to understand how somebody would love a cup of coffee. You'd love if you could just, you know, read a book and get up the next morning and life is just as you left it last night. I mean, just the simplest things. And yet, you know, they're the doves and the red scarves and all the things that might take our eye away from what needs to be front and center.
You have been a busy writer doing a lot of short stories, and yet this is your first novel in 17 years. What kept you?
Well, I've been working on it. I mean, the novel has been in progress for, you know, or the notion of it for a dozen years and a lot of note taking. But my own life was in transition in many ways. I mean, I made a major move back to the South, new job, you know, my kids were teenagers and in the house. And I was teaching full time, so I just didn't have that great big space of time that I felt like this novel required.
And I've heard you talk about this, the idea that when you take on a novel, it takes you on in ways that require much more time. It's, I think I've heard you say that the novel is simply not as portable. Is that right? Is that an idea?
That's how it's not for me. And I did work on short stories. I wasn't just not.
You weren't goofing off.
I wasn't goofing
we'll
off. I wrote stories. I wrote some essays. But no, the novel for me requires, you know, speaking of inner and outer life. The novel for me requires, you know, being in the head on the stage much more than life sometimes allows us. And
also have some thoughts about this idea of sort of having to write, you know, 2 hours a day or 1,000 pages a day as a professional writer. And you think there's a kind of there may be a little gender split there. Is that right? On writing, on who it is that spends 2 hours in front of a typewriter. Well, I could have gotten some bad information on this, but the idea that this is the kind of thing that guys do, but in many ways, if you've got a full life and a lot of other things going on, writing comes differently, and you approach writing in a different way.
Well, I think I've had a lot of hats to wear, and maybe I'm just not a very good multitasker. I don't know.
Louis Rubin, but, very important to you as a teacher and a mentor. Tell
absolutely.
Us, remind us about him and his impact on many of the writers you included in this.
Well,
in this
Louis, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair talking to you without Louis Rubin. I mean, he was my teacher and founder of Algonquin. And so, you know, he's been my teacher, my friend, my publisher, and connected me with Shannon Ravenel in the very beginning. And she has now been my editor for 28, going on 29 years.
Remarkably, you debuted two novels at once. Your debut novel were twins.
Yes, I had twins. and you know, I tell people, I mean, I've had a lot of jobs. I've lived in a lot of places. I've had one publisher.
No.
And one editor. So I've been with Algonquin the whole time, and they're about to celebrate 30 years.
Pretty exciting. Thank you very much, Jill. So great to have you back on the program and see you back in print, this time with a novel.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Jill McCorkle's new novel is Life After Life. She's going to be reading tonight at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, and she will be around the region for some weeks to come. Coming up next on this program, we're going to look at one woman's quest to fight the violence that took her son. Stay tuned.